everyone was a bit of a Monday morning quarterback after the US election result. But one criticism that I at least saw a lot of people levy was that Kamala Harris tried too hard to appeal to Republicans rather than being boldly progressive. And do you have any concerns about your party moving in that direction, in the fight against Poilievre?
Yeah, we're not gonna out Poilievre. Like that's not what we're gonna do. And I don't want to, right? Like I don't want to have his brand of politics. I don't want to try to say that we're not going to stand up for the things that have been important for us as liberals.
I'm Rachel Gilmore, your least favorite person's least favorite journalist. Welcome to Bubble Pop, a weekly show where we break down the biggest headlines so you don't have to doom scroll. Then we'll dig deeper into something juicy that you should know about. In this episode, we've got liberal leadership contender Carina Gould on the show. She's the youngest and most progressive liberal voice in the race, and she's not afraid to stand behind liberal policies that have had, branding issues. Will the liberals make the same mistakes the Democrats made down south? I ask her those questions. But first, the news. In this week's roundup, we're talking tariffs, tariffs, tariffs. There's also been a major U.S. Supreme Court decision that is actually slightly reassuring. Trump addressed Congress this week, and the Democrats failed to meet the moment. The world is responding as the U.S. turns on Ukraine. Attacks on trans folks' rights in the U.S. are continuing, and the liberal leadership race will crown its champion on Sunday. Let's dive in. The big story this week is obviously tariffs. You're probably sick of hearing that word. I know I am. But unfortunately, it's a big problem for us all. Not only that, but Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has a warning for Canadians about why Trump is attacking his so-called best buddies here in Canada.
Even the excuse that he's giving for these Paris tariffs today of fentanyl is completely bogus, completely unjustified, completely false. So we actually have to fold back on the one thing he has said repeatedly, that what he wants is to see a total collapse of the Canadian economy. Because that'll make it easier to annex us, is the second half of his thought. Now, first of all, that's never going to happen. We will never be the 51st state.
Yeah. And in case that didn't drive it home enough, here's the White House press secretary saying something similar.
Plans that are moving forward with trying to make Canada the 51st state. And I have a follow-up on the economy as well.
Sure. Well, the president put that in his True Social account, or his True Social post earlier today. He feels strongly that it would be very beneficial for the Canadian people to be the 51st state of the United States. They wouldn't be paying for these tariffs. They'd have much lower taxes if they were part of our great country.
So Canadians are understandably not happy. And things are escalating fast, which means that by the time you hear the summary, what I'm telling you might be outdated. In fact, the news changed as I was writing this script. Right now, as I'm filming this Thursday evening, the Trump administration granted Canada and Mexico a one-month exemption for tariffs on goods that fall under the CUSMA agreement. So that's fun. I guess this is just a horrifying monthly dance we do now, huh? Trump also agreed to grant an exemption on auto tariffs for 1 month after he spoke to Ford, General Motors, and Stellantis, with the expectation that the companies will move production to the U.S. as soon as possible. Meanwhile, Canada has been fighting back against the tariffs, with provinces pulling booze from red states off of Canadian liquor store shelves. Ford also once again ripped up the Starlink deal with Ontario, which he already very publicly ripped up once and then meekly stitched back together. And the Ontario premier has pledged to slap a 25% tariff on the electricity Ontario ships to 1.5 million U.S. customers come Monday. Canada also levied counter tariffs on $30 billion worth of U.S. goods. Meanwhile, NDP leader Jagmeet Singh wants Parliament to come back so they can pass emergency supports for workers, although the NDP also promised to bring down the government at the next opportunity, and so did the Conservatives and the Bloc. So, as for the Conservatives, at a time when income inequality is terrible and tariffs are expected to hit consumers hard, Poilievre is calling for the funds from counter tariffs to go towards tax cuts. Yes, really. Specifically, he wants the government to cut the carbon tax, the sales tax on new homes, the capital gains tax, and income tax. A lot of that would benefit wealthy Canadians, so that's fun. But hey, at least the events of this week gave us this incredible clip of Polyev's body appearing to physically reject the statement that he's not MAGA, as Trump said. Watch this. It's very funny.
The president says that he doesn't like me. He doesn't think that I'm a MAGA guy. I am not. It is true that I am Canada first. I am only for Canada. I'm fighting for the interests of this people and this country. And if that upsets foreign leaders, including the American president, I'm fine with that because I have one job to do, and it's to fight for this country.
Anyways, this whole tariff dance is very stupid, but its impact is sadly very, very real for all of us. And the justifications Trump keeps giving for imposing these tariffs are, as Trudeau put it, bogus. Canada makes up just 0.2% of the U.S. border fentanyl seizures Trump is so worried about, and Trump keeps claiming that Canada prohibits U.S. banks, which is also bullshit. 16 U.S.-based bank subsidiaries and branches currently operate in Canada. Trump decided to lie about Canada's very democracy this week, too, claiming that Trudeau is using the tariffs to run again for prime minister, which is so stupid on so many levels, not the least of which being Trudeau has already announced his plans to resign, and the only time he'll linger is during a transition period, which, to be clear, is a very normal thing. The transition from Harper to Trudeau took about 16 days. Anyways, does your brain hurt yet? Mine does. So let's punish ourselves more by talking about the U.S. Supreme Court. Actually, this is slightly good news, because you know how we've been talking about how the Supreme Court decisions on key Trump administration actions will show us just how much damage he'll be able to do to their country? Well, the Supreme Court just narrowly voted to rein in the self-professed king on his effort to stop paying USAID contractors. In a 5-4 decision, which is way too close, they found that a federal judge did actually have the authority to force the Trump administration to pay about $2 billion to USAID contractors. And that's for work they had already completed, for the record. Now, this is a pretty narrow ruling, but it does give us a glimmer of hope that maybe, just maybe, the Supreme Court will nut up and stop Trump from totally blowing up the branches of government and asserting unprecedented levels of control over U.S. democracy. We'll see if they keep those nuts up in future, more consequential decisions, though. Speaking of nutting up, the Democrats have been absolutely blowing it when it comes to standing up to Trump. One of them, Representative Al Green, actually had the stones to protest Trump's address to Congress on Tuesday, and the House, including 10 Democrats, voted to censure him for it. Meanwhile, as Trump lied consistently throughout the speech, the Democrats decided to undertake a very brave act of protest. They wore pink. Yeah. And some of them also wore black or yellow or blue. Powerful. Really meeting the moment, guys. Meanwhile, another powerful Democrat who has been viewed as a contender for the 2028 presidential election, California Governor Gavin Newsom, just launched a podcast. His first guest, Charlie Kirk. A man who has called trans people a, quote, abomination and a, quote, throbbing middle finger to God. This comes as one week ago, Iowa's governor signed a bill removing gender identity from state civil rights protections. This is the first time a U.S. state has stripped a protected class of people from laws prohibiting discrimination. Meanwhile, on his show, Newsom basically caved to Kirk's hateful transphobic rhetoric because apparently it's more important to do what's popular in manosphere right-wing communities than it is to do what's right. Pathetic. Later in the show, I'm going to ask liberal leadership contender Karina Gould about the idea of liberals trying to outright wing the right wing. So stay tuned for that. Turning to the international community now, things are getting real spooky. Following the shit show that was the ambush in the White House against Zelensky, the Trump administration paused military aid to Ukraine, a move Trudeau described as part of a shift from the U.S. towards, quote, appeasing Putin. In response, European leaders and Canada have been doubling down on backing Ukraine, including offers to contribute troops to a, quote, coalition of the willing peacekeeping force in the event of a ceasefire. But Russia has reacted strongly to the suggestion, stating that the presence of European peacekeepers in Ukraine would signal direct NATO involvement in the war. That's a stance that they've held since before the U.S. threw Zelensky under the bus. Like, in late January, Russia responded to musings about peacekeepers with a warning that this would threaten to cause a, quote, uncontrollable escalation. Europe, meanwhile, has come out and said it is responding to these, quote, most momentous and dangerous of times with a, quote, era of rearmament. Oh, and in case your blood pressure wants one final reason to spike, China is really pissed off about the U.S. tariffs and in response took to Twitter to say it's ready to fight, quote, any type of war against the U.S. Specifically, they said, quote, if war is what the U.S. wants, be it a tariff war, a trade war, or any other type of war, we're ready to fight till the end. God, the U.S. really fucked us all with their decision to elect Trump, didn't they? Thanks a lot, guys. Speaking of elections, Canada's going to find out who Justin Trudeau's replacement is going to be this weekend. On March 9th, the Liberal Party will tally the votes in its leadership race. So far, it seems like economist Mark Carney is the frontrunner, with former Deputy Prime Minister Chrystia Freeland nipping at his heels. The voting will take place in the form of a ranked ballot, which means that people will rank their picks from first to last. If no one gets over 50% support, then the person with the least votes drops off, and then their votes are redistributed based on the second choice picks on those ballots. So who knows? Maybe Sunday will be more exciting than we think. But probably not. The one thing that really has shifted over the course of this race, though, is that I think a lot of us initially thought the Liberals would be choosing a sort of sacrificial lamb to serve up to lose to Conservative leader Pierre Poilievre in the next election. But now that the polls are really tightening, whoever wins the leadership could have an actual shot at winning the next election. And no, Trump, it's not going to be Trudeau. That's the weekly news roundup. After the break, we've got one of the Liberal leadership hopefuls on the show. Carina Gould thinks that the Liberals shouldn't try to be conservative light. But the question is, does the rest of her party agree? We'll be right back. Carina Gould wasn't a name that many people had on their bingo cards when we started speculating about who was going to be the next Liberal leader. But the 37-year-old, who is almost two decades younger than anyone else in the Liberal leadership race, quickly emerged as the dark horse candidate. She stood out in the leadership debates, taking firm progressive stances and pressing frontrunner Mark Carney on some of his statements. And while other candidates have tried to distance themselves from some Trudeau government decisions, Gould hasn't been afraid to stand behind the things she believes worked. Taken together, she might be one of the most interesting voices to emerge in this leadership race. So I'm very excited to welcome Carina Gould on the show. Carina, welcome to Bubble Pop.
Thanks for having me, Rachel.
Now, you've been quite progressive in your stances in this race. You've emphasized the importance of a social safety net and called for universal basic income. Most of the other candidates seem to be trying to sell themselves as more centrist. Why are you choosing this different approach?
Well, I'm just being true to who I am. I'm putting forward the ideas that I think are important for our country, that I think are important for Canadians. And, you know, I am proud of, you know, many of the things that we've been able to achieve as a Liberal government. And I also think that what I'm putting forward speaks to Liberal members. You talk about a universal basic income. That is something that has been on the convention floor for the past four conventions, and it's passed overwhelmingly each time. So I'm not afraid to be a progressive voice. I'm not afraid to stand up for the things that I believe in and to put those ideas out there to Liberals and to hopefully to Canadians.
Speaking to David Akin in January, some of your colleagues seem to think that Justin Trudeau moved the party too far to the left and that this played a key role in the decline of the Liberals. What did you think when you heard that criticism? Do you agree with that?
Well, look, I mean, I think there's mixed feelings about the supply and confidence agreement with the NDP. I think that for many Liberals was a tough pill to swallow. But I think more than anything, you know, what was challenging for our party was that, you know, at the moment in time when Canadians were saying that they needed help post-pandemic with the cost of living, we weren't really focused on that. And I think more than anything, it's about, were we listening to what Canadians were telling us and were they satisfied with the government's response? And I think the answer is no on both of those fronts. So for me, it's important to demonstrate to Canadians that I'm listening to them and that I'm focused on the issues that matter. You know, obviously the long shadow of Trump has been cast over this leadership race and across the country entirely, but that doesn't mean that cost of living issues have receded from importance for people. I mean, that's why I put out policies on, you know, reducing the GST from 5% to 4%. It's why I put out policies calling for more competition in Canada, a really bold and ambitious housing plan that will tackle the housing crisis. And as you mentioned, modernizing our social safety net. These are things that matter for us as Canadians. And, you know, it's been really interesting to watch how the other candidates have tried to adapt to my messaging and take on some of the issues that I've been putting forward. You know, I've really been leading in the policy ideas space. And that's something I'm really proud of. And, you know, I'm glad to see that I'm changing the conversation in this race in general.
Do you feel as though you're pushing your competitors to be a little bit more progressive in some of the stances that they're taking?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's interesting. You know, I made the comment during the debates, but I believe it. We're not going to win the next election by being conservative light. There's already a Conservative Party of Canada. You know, we should be liberals and we should be true to our values. And what does being a liberal mean? It's a big tent party. We have people on the center left. We have people on the center right. We have people smack dab in the middle. But what has always been the reason for me to be a proud liberal and to be excited to be part of this party is that we should be able to and we can have those really robust discussions. So, you know, I think it's a good thing to show that there is that diversity within our party.
You know, I find it really interesting when you mentioned the conservative light thing because, you know, I mean, everyone was a bit of a Monday morning quarterback after the U.S. election result. But one criticism that I at least saw a lot of people levy was that Kamala Harris tried too hard to appeal to Republicans rather than being boldly progressive. And do you have any concerns about your party moving in that direction in the fight against Polyev?
Yeah, we're not going to out Polyev. Like, that's, you know, that's not what we're going to do. And I don't want to, right? Like, I don't want to have his brand of politics. I don't want to, you know, try to say that we're not going to stand up for the things that have been important for us as liberals. You know, we've always put forward bold ideas that have moved this country forward. You know, we wouldn't have universal health care if it weren't for a Liberal government. We wouldn't have the national child care program if it weren't for a Liberal government. And we wouldn't have legalized same-sex marriage in this country or legalized cannabis if it wasn't for a Liberal government. Those were all bold ideas at the time that have now become mainstream and accepted. So I, you know what, I don't want to be conservative light. That's not who I am. And I don't think it's who we are as liberals either. And, you know, like, I think to the point about, you know, the situation in the US was different, but there are lessons that we can learn from it. But I think the thing is like, you don't necessarily win elections by playing it safe. You win elections by inspiring people, by sharing your vision for Canada and giving them reason to be hopeful and to be optimistic. And Pierre Polyev is selling his own kind of weird, dark version of hope in a way. But, you know, I think what brought us into power into 2015, and I think what would keep a new version of a Liberal government in office is, you know, harnessing that hope for people and giving people something to feel hopeful about. This is a weird, scary, tough time that we are living in, but I think that there is reason to be hopeful and there is reason to be optimistic, but that's got to be our brand. That's got to be who we are. And it's got to be what motivates people to come out and vote for us.
One notable Trudeau era policy that you have stood behind that sets you apart from some of your competitors is on the price on carbon. You're saying that the party should sort of salvage it. Can you tell me a bit more about that position?
Yeah, look, I'm not going to just bow down to what Pierre Polyev says that we should do. I mean, I'm going to stand behind a policy that works. Look, Pierre Polyev has erroneously and incorrectly misled Canadians to say that the reason why things cost more is because of the price on pollution. We know that's factually incorrect. The reason why things cost more is because of inflation. And so if we're going to tackle the root cause of what people are upset about when they're talking about the carbon tax, it's not that they're saying that they don't care about fighting climate change. It's not that they're saying that they don't care about protecting the environment. What they're saying is things are really unaffordable and we need help. And the fact of the matter is that removing the consumer price on pollution is not going to make things cheaper. right? We know that. The Parliamentary Budget Officer has come out and said that. But what we do know is that people are struggling to make ends meet. So let's put forward policies that are going to help them. Reducing the GST by 1%. That'll make a big difference, particularly for low and no income Canadians who spend more of their income on the GST than wealthier Canadians. Taking away the carbon rebate, you know, that could be $1,200 a year for a family of four. Not going to make things more affordable for Canadians. Let's tackle the housing crisis. Let's build more homes. Let's make sure that we're working towards eliminating homelessness and getting first-time homebuyers into the market. What people are saying to us is they're struggling to make ends meet. So let's actually put forward policies that are going to help them reduce their costs and make life more affordable.
It definitely stood out to me that Polyev's attacks on the carbon tax were so effective. I mean, a price on carbon is, if anything, a conservative market-based solution to climate change. So I'm kind of curious, like, do you have concerns about how dishonest rhetoric like that and decisions to cave to dishonest rhetoric, which arguably is what we're seeing in the response to sort of leave the price on carbon by the roadside by some of your competitors here. Do you have concerns about how caving to dishonest rhetoric can shape our politics?
Yeah, well, I think, I mean, it leads to policy that's not effective. And ultimately, you know, our job as the government is to govern effectively. And, you know, it's a policy that both reduces emissions. So it's responsible for 10 to 15% of our emissions reduction. But, you know, Polyev has made it so toxic and he's made it a catch-all for everything that I can understand why, you know, my colleagues in this race would like to move away from it to try and open up a different space to have a conversation. So I understand why they're doing it. I just feel personally that it's important to stand by your convictions and it's important to have an honest conversation with Canadians about it. And you know what? As a government, we missed the moment. We, you know, didn't take it seriously. We thought we had won three elections on the price on pollution. You know, we had won three elections, but I would argue on very different things. You know, that wasn't the top issue for Canadians. And even, you know, in 2021, the Conservatives ran on kind of a wonky version of the price on pollution. I mean, Erin O'Toole had this like weird, like green savings account where you could use money to buy green, like, you know, more environmentally friendly things. So it was like, I don't know, the Conservatives always put forward ideas that, you know, they say they don't want big government and then they have like even more control than, you know, what the free market asks for. But, you know, Pierre Polyev is a smart politician. I don't like what he stands for and I don't like the way that he does it, but he is an effective politician. And so we need somebody who can, you know, go head to head and be an effective politician, but on the progressive side to go against him.
One thing I've wondered about, you know, speaking of running on certain promises is, you know, when Trudeau announced his plans to resign, he said his biggest regret was not achieving electoral reform in the form of a ranked ballot. I think the specification there annoyed some people since not only were they angry that Trudeau hadn't achieved electoral reform, but they felt his focus on a ranked ballot outcome was part of the reason that it didn't work out. You served as Minister for Democratic Institutions and were the one to announce that the government had to abandon or was abandoning that promise. Do you have any regrets about how that played out?
Well, look, I came in at the tail end of that process, but what I will say is that we were pretty naive, I think, in 2015 about how we approached that promise and thinking that we could put together a parliamentary committee that would somehow come to an agreement and put partisanship aside and do what was best for the country on one of the most political issues there is, choosing how MPs are elected, how our representative are elected, was maybe too naive at the time. Because what ended up happening on that committee is that every political party put forward their preferred method and none of them agreed on it. And the only thing, two things that they agreed on that committee was that there would be no mandatory voting and no electronic voting. Otherwise, they disagreed on everything else. So I think that it just wasn't the right approach to do it. And, you know, it's very hard to do this. And it's also something that, you know, if I were to do it differently, I think I would do a citizens assembly and then put the outcome of a citizens assembly to a referendum. I don't think you can change how we govern ourselves, how we choose our representatives without bringing it to the people more broadly. I think what I learned through that process, and you know, my colleague Miriam Monsef experienced it on a daily basis when she was in the role before me, is that if you don't have a referendum, you will not have the legitimacy to change that system. The Conservatives asked her 20 questions a day on whether or not they would we would hold a referendum. So I think it's the only way that if we are going to do it, that we could do it.
Do you think Trudeau shouldn't have made that promise about it being the last election under first past the post?
He made the promise because he believed that it would be possible. And, you know, in a democracy, not everything is possible. That's democracy. You know, it's always interesting to me when people, you know, talk about, and I get that they're disappointed because they care about it, and that's fine. And that's good. And that's the issue that they're pushing. And that's democracy. But it's, you still have to govern. And you still have to get things through the House of Commons. And even when you have a majority government, and this is a good thing, you still shouldn't be able to do everything, right? And I'm not saying specifically on this case, but just in general, that is a democracy. You have to get through Parliament. You have to sell things to your country, to your citizens. And so, you know, you might have the best of intentions, but maybe the way that you did it, it didn't work out. And it's not because you didn't want to achieve it. It's because, you know, if you can't sell it to, you know, the broader public or to Parliament beyond, you know, your party, even in a majority government, sometimes it just makes it politically untenable. So for me, that experience taught me a lot about how to get things done in politics and in Parliament. And I think that was a particularly valuable lesson for me.
So that actually segues really well. Speaking of, I guess, lessons learned about doing politics, I mean, part of your pitch has been that as House Leader, you've outsmarted Polyev on several confidence votes, as you put it, and stopped him from bringing the government down. So what do you think is key to handling a personality like Polyev?
I'm not sure I want to answer that.
That makes me want you to answer it even more.
let me just say that I think it's about being thoughtful and smart and understanding the person that you're going against and what their objectives are. And when you can understand what their objectives are, you can find ways to make sure that you get what you want.
You know, between people like Polyev and Trump, we are seeing a real sort of rise of post-truth populism, rife with attacks on media and conspiracy theory dog whistles. I know that you've had an interest in politics your whole life, from being class president to studying political science. So based on your lifetime of experience and interest in this arena, how do you think we can keep our democracy strong in the face of this changing world?
Oh, what that is the question.
It is, isn't it?
I mean, I have to say that, like, it's actually been one of the biggest shocks to me over the last 10 years is seeing the decline in political discourse and conversations here in Canada, but also around the world. You know, what I hear post leadership debate, you know, from political observers is how much they, you know, the media was like, it was a really boring debate, but for Canadians who were watching, were like, oh wow, it was such a cordial conversation. You know, yes, you know, I was the one that pushed, but I didn't push very hard. But you know, I could have gone harder if I wanted to, but to, like, to have a respectful dialogue. And I think that's one of the things that, you know, we have a choice in this country as to whether or not we want to elevate the political discourse and the dialogue and the conversation, or whether we're going to go down to the level that we're seeing, you know, with the Polyevs and the Trumps of this world. And it is, you know, this is actually one thing that that I learned from the Prime Minister back in 2015, that it's a lot easier to be negative in politics. It's a lot easier to, you know, see people's anger and reflect it back at them and not have to actually put, you know, ideas or policies or solutions on the table. It's a lot harder to be positive and to present solutions in politics. But I think it's the right thing to do. And so I think that's our choice is, you know, do we want to go down to that level and get into the gutter? Or do we want to, you know, do what we can to have, you know, a more respectful dialogue when it comes to politics? And I know that you've experienced this as well. It's not always an easy thing to do. And they're like, you know, being online and on social media, it's easier to be a keyboard warrior and say and do awful things. And we've certainly seen that increase. I mean, like, you know, don't look at the comments on any of my social media posts if you don't want to, you know, get depressed about the world. But at the same time, like, I don't know, I'm just going to choose hope, positivity, respect, as we move forward. I think that's just what we have to do, and we have to model that kind of behavior. It doesn't mean that you can't have tough conversations. It doesn't mean that you don't criticize. I think you do all of that. You can just do it in a way that is respectful of others.
On the topic of tough conversations, I did want to touch on Gaza. You know, Amnesty International and a UN special committee both found that Israel is committing genocide in Gaza. Most recently, Israel decided to withhold humanitarian aid from Gaza as a negotiation tactic to pressure Hamas into accepting new ceasefire terms. Depriving humanitarian aid is prohibited under the Geneva Conventions. We know that you oppose Trump's plan to ethnically cleanse Gaza in the future, but what about the very real violations of international law happening to Palestinians right now? What can we expect you to do to try to stop this?
Well, so look, I mean, first of all, I mean, Trump's plan is, I mean, that's not even possible, and it's not real, and it doesn't help peace in the region at all. My position has always been to do everything we can towards peace. Look, Hamas committed some horrific atrocities on October 7th, and we need to do everything we can towards peace. I've always been for a two-state solution where Israelis and Palestinians live side by side in peace and security. Humanitarian assistance into Gaza should be non-negotiable. There has been too much suffering, and that suffering needs to end. And the only way we're going to be able to move towards peace is if there is a real and viable reconstruction in Gaza where people have an opportunity to live free, secure, and prosperous lives side by side with an Israeli state. Has to be that there is no space for Hamas to be in a future government in Gaza. That is important both for the security of Israelis, but also for the freedom and self-determination of Palestinians in Gaza. So from my point of view, you know, we have to ensure that humanitarian assistance gets into Gaza in a robust and meaningful way.
Would your liberal government comply with the ICC order with respect to Netanyahu, you know, the arrest warrant?
Well, look, we believe in international law, and so my government would follow international law.
All right. And bringing things back to Canada, I do kind of want to round off with a question about how everyone's feeling right now. People are having a tough time, right? As we sort of spoke about a little bit earlier, they're scared, they're angry, and it sometimes feels like our shared reality is under threat, and with it, our ability to fully participate in a healthy democracy. What do you feel your responsibility is in helping to mend this, and how do you intend to do that?
Oh, look, there is a desire among some parts of the population to intimidate and dissuade people from participating in our democracy, because they know that if they intimidate them, that they will back down because they're afraid. And that's just not acceptable. And, you know, I've had this experience as a elected member of parliament, and certainly as a woman, but if you're, you know, a member of a visible minority, you know, you experience it even more, that, you know, sometimes it feels like, well, is it worth it for me to raise my voice if I know that I'm going to be attacked for it? My personal feeling is that I have to, because I don't want to let them win. I don't want to cede the space to the voices that are trying to bring people down and push people out. And so, you know, I think that we have to have more effective legislation for online harms and hate speech online. You know, growing up in a digital world, if you utter a threat in person or you utter it online, I don't really understand what the difference is, because people live their lives online, and people should feel safe in every space in which they operate, whether that's in the physical world or the online world. And I will say that, you know, one of my like great disappointments is that we weren't able to get Bill C-63 on online harms and hate speech online through the House of Commons. The Conservatives pulled out every trick in the book to prevent this. And like, I just want to be clear, this is like legislation that would also, you know, protect children from, you know, like sexual predators online. Like this is stuff that like should be a no-brainer, I would think, for everyone in this country, because I don't know why we would say that hate and abuse are okay online when they're not okay on, you know, on the street. So for me, that is something that I would pursue. I think we need to bring back Section 13 of the Human Rights Code in Canada that was removed by Stephen Harper and that led to, you know, an explosion of hateful activity online. And this is something that I think is important for everyone in Canada, because you should feel safe and be safe, not just feel safe, but be safe in all of these spaces.
Yeah, I think it's so interesting to me the way that people don't seem to believe that the online world is real life, when it's real people, for the most part, behind those computers and those thoughts and, you know, saying these messages, and the impact is very real regardless. So,
well, and try saying that to like a kid, right? You know, try saying that to a high school student who, you know, lives their entire life, not their entire life, but spends like a large portion of their life online. Like, it's just, you know, I think it's an outdated perspective, and I think we need to, you know, to update our laws to reflect the reality in which we live now.
Yep, absolutely. Karina, I think that's pretty much all the questions that I had for you today, but I do just want to give you the floor for a second. First of all, to tell people where they can keep up with you, but also if there's anything we didn't get a chance to touch on that you feel is important for the Canadian people to know about you, or a message you think they might need to hear right now, I just want to give you the floor for a moment.
Sure. So you can follow me online. My handles everywhere are at Karina Gould. They're pretty simple. I love talking to younger people that are like, wow, how did you get your name? And I'm like, I was there when it started. But anyways, so you can absolutely follow me there. I guess I have two things that I'll say. One is, look, with everything that's happening in the United States right now, I know there is a lot of anxiety for people here in Canada about what this means, maybe for your job, maybe for our economy, for our way of life, for the values that we care about. And I just want to reassure you that, you know, your leaders, me as a leader in this country, are doing everything we can to stand up for Canada and for Canadians. And I have a lot of confidence in who we are as a people. I'm so proud of how everyday Canadians have been, you know, responding, how they're going to the grocery store, they're looking for Canadian products, they're, you know, shopping from Canadian retailers, and, you know, deciding not to go to Florida on vacation and staying at home. I think that, you know, is and not staying at home, but like vacationing here in Canada. These are all important things that we can do as individuals. And now is the time where we need to stay united in light of, you know, this completely ill-considered action and aggressive action by Donald Trump in the United States. And I think now is also the time for us to be true to who we are as Canadians and to live our values and to, you know, really be proud of who we are. And I guess the final thing that I'll say is for anyone who has registered in the Liberal leadership race, in order to vote, you need to make sure that your identity is verified by 5 p.m. Eastern time on Friday, and you need to cast your ballot before Sunday afternoon. So don't forget to do that. If you have any trouble, you can reach out to my team. We're happy to help people in the best way that we can. But it's important that you cast your ballot. Democracy matters. Votes matter. If anyone says that they don't, in Burlington, in the last provincial election that happened last week, the Liberal candidate lost by 40 votes. So every single vote matters and your voice matters. I look forward to carrying on this dialogue with Canadians. So thanks for having me, Rachel.
Yeah, thank you so much for your time, Karina.
My pleasure.
Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of Bubble Pop. I'm Rachel Gilmore, your least favorite person's least favorite journalist. If you enjoyed this episode, consider subscribing to Bubble Pop on YouTube, Patreon, Substack, and wherever you like to listen. You can also find me on TikTok, Instagram, Twitch, and Blue Sky. I'd like to say a special thank you to Hans Vivian Wenzel for making the incredibly groovy music for Bubble Pop. You can find more of his stuff on Spotify under the artist name Hans, lowercase h with an exclamation mark. Thanks again for spending this time with me. Doing this is a literal dream job, and I could not do it without your support. So thank you, and I'll see you next time.